Welcome to the Azure Podcast, a series of short discussions on various topics related to the Microsoft Cloud Platform. Your hosts, Kale Teeter, Evan Basilik, and Sujit Mello, discuss a specific topic on each show to give you a high-level overview of that topic and resources to get more information should you wish to dig further. For more information on our show, please see our website at azpodcast.com. Welcome back to the Azure Podcast. This is episode number 194, being recorded on the 7th of September, 2017, with special guest Mark Eisenberg. And Sujit, and on Skype with me, I have Kale, Evan, and our special guest Mark. And as usual, before we get to Mark, let's just quickly cover some of the recent updates in the Azure space. And I want to say a fairly busy week. Thanks, Evan and Kale, for putting all those resources in the show notes. So, which ones do you guys want to start with?
I'll jump in first. So the one of the ones that, and I actually didn't know you couldn't do this, right? So I'm not a hardcore storage person. I use it, you know, I use it for some personal stuff. I use it for some stuff at work. But, you know, really doing fine-grained access to storage accounts is not, I mean, I know you can do it, but it's not something I've ever tried to manage. I didn't realize that when you create these SaaS URLs, you can't manage them in the portal, or couldn't up until very recently. So now we've added that. So, and not only do you have the ability to manage them in there, but you can see all the ones that are out there. You can revoke them. You can do, you know, whatever you need to do, both kind of getting a sense of what's there and, you know, controlling the ones that, controlling them from there.
That's handy, I got to tell you, because otherwise, I remember you had to write all sorts of PowerShell scripts to figure out what was in there.
Yeah. Yeah, and there's a lot of tools like, you know, like Azure Storage Explorer. Yeah, the open source one that we have, or multi-platform one we have. Like, you can create them easy, right?
Yeah.
But managing them after you create them has not been as easy historically.
Good. That's a good one. Kale, what do you like?
No.
I'm taking the blockchain one, so don't
okay.
take that one.
There's a couple. I'll let that blockchain one for later. The one that actually stands out more that I do day-to-day is the ARM templates with conditions and logical functions. Mm. This is like a godsend.
Yeah, that's huge.
We build a lot of these templates for partners. I mean, I spend most of my day doing this. And so, you know, we had to kind of dance around these. And actually, in the blog article, you can see how we kind of did that before, where we used link templates and faked it to kind of do these conditionals. But now we have real provisions in there, real constructs to do that. It was pretty funny because I remember early on talking to the team, and it was like, we're not building a programming language, guys. Like, yeah, we are. Okay. So it's just...
Yeah. Now, remind me, the nested templates, is that the same as link templates?
Yeah. I mean, basically, you can pull in or import, basically, other templates on the fly.
Right,
so you
could
basically construct a URL and then say, if this, you know, when this value in this field changes to this, link this template in. And so you could fake conditionals. Yeah.
Okay. Good. Yeah, I think that's a good one. Well, I actually watched that video of Mark Rusinovich and Seth Juarez on blockchain on Channel 9. And I got to tell you, that's a really nice video. I mean, I think if I didn't understand Bitcoin and blockchain before, I totally got it now, you know. So definitely, I think our listeners should take a look at that one. That together with the, there was another video that I saw with Ernst & Young doing something together with Microsoft on the marine insurance business. And they had some really nice, compelling reasons why insurance business should be running on a blockchain. And I'll put that in there as well. It's not in the show notes right now, but I'll put it on the website.
There was just a big announcement about, what was it, Maersk, right?
That's the same one.
Yeah,
same one, yeah.
Yeah, that was a good article. I read at least some variant of that. That makes a lot of sense, right, in that very distributed world.
Yeah, and what was nice is they created these, like, a bunch of about four really nice videos, right, about, like, 2 or 3 minutes each.
Yeah.
Really explained, you know, because Yeah, when you think of blockchain insurance, I'm like, oh, okay, come on, guys. What's the draw here? But they really explained how blockchain can help something like this, and then it opens up your eyes to all sorts of other use cases for blockchain. So, wow, look at that! I took over Cale's role and talked about blockchain.
I told you it's a revolution, man. You
I
guys
know.
will all be part of this
It's
eventually. It's not a problem.
spreading. All right, what else you guys like in there? Here's one that I think Mark might find interesting. So the Windows authentication in Service Fabric and ASP.NET 2.0. So now Service Fabric supports ASP.NET Core 2.0, and why that's important is that ASP.NET Core 2.0 has this web listener, and so you can obviously use a web listener to stand up a microservice inside of Service Fabric. But the web listener supports Windows authentication, which I think previously was, I think was difficult to do or not available. I don't recall. And so, so this is a big deal now that we have it in Service Fabric.
I think another one here that stands out is for those that are looking to use some of this new stuff with the bots. There's an article out here about the bot conversation history with Cosmo DB. So basically, a lot of these things when you're having a conversation with an AI or a bot is around the state of what has been asked. That's kind of the magic behind a lot of that stuff to say. When you have a conversation, you don't need to explain yourself every time you ask a question or type something new into an interface or whatnot. But that's all driven by state, right? And so being able to leverage some of our other platform services such as Cosmo DB to kind of hold that state for us in an easy way is, I think, a pretty cool thing for bot guys. So as they start kind of building these things up, the more automatic we can make that kind of state tracking behind the scenes, the better.
Yep, definitely a good one there. And I'm surprised no one's talking about the big one, right? Which is Azure App Service now available on generally available on Linux. This used to be in preview service before. I think this, I think that for me, the big draw on this one is that you can have web apps hosted in containers, right? So you know, Docker containers can have all these frameworks that they run in them right now, and most of them, unfortunately, I shouldn't say unfortunately, but most of them run using a Linux, the Linux-based containers. And so you could now take one of those containers and run it inside of this app service that runs in Linux, and you have your website running in Azure App Service, which I think is pretty cool.
Yeah, because App Service was the original kind of easily scalable up and down and vertically and horizontally service, right? And so it is nice to be able to do a lot of that stuff with Linux now.
Yeah, and it opens up all these additional languages, right? Like
Yeah.
Go, Python, PHP, all that stuff, which may not be available in the Windows versions. So it's
I'd
all
be
good.
interested to see, and maybe you guys didn't know this because I haven't worked as much with the app service and this web app for containers capability, but a lot of ones I work with, they do Docker Compose, which is basically, bringing in a couple different container images at one time, right? So they all interoperate together and they have dependencies on each other. Is it advanced enough to do that, or is it really just simplified to say no? You have to kind of manage that yourself. You just spin up the containers one at a time with this.
I think you gotta bring your image there, right? Essentially, I mean, I don't think are you saying that you can actually create the image dynamically? Is that what you mean?
No, I mean with Docker Compose, you can basically create a config file that says, here's my five images. They
Right.
all work together to build this solution. So go run this. And it'll just on like even one server with Docker on it, it'll basically go create five containers, let's say, in the right order and all that stuff. This one feels a little bit more simplified, right? You just bring one image, you can't
It's
bring
just one
multiple.
image. Yeah, I think that's what it is. Yeah,
Okay.
you're right. Good point. Okay, great.
There was one other one here just to hit on because we talked about before was the Azure Management Libraries. We kind of talk about those from time to time, and we had someone on talking about, I think, both the
Acer.
Java ended on it.
Yeah,
Acer was on, yeah.
I was going to say not too long ago, but then I went and looked it up. That was almost a year ago.
Wow. And that was
Episode
version
154.
1.0.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it looks like there's a 1.2 version that adds, more support, more security deployment features. So they're continuing to kind of extend that. I guess that means it's popular, that people are using it. So that's a good sign.
Indeed, yeah, that syntax for creating the, all the Azure resources is pretty nice. Okay, I guess that's a good roundup of all the updates. So let's move over to our guest, who has been on the show before, so he shouldn't be new to our listeners, but I'll let him introduce himself anyways. Mark, can you give our listeners or remind them about your background and what you do at Microsoft and your passion in the cloud?
I guess I should have listened to my old one so I know what my intro was.
Yeah, they gotta compare notes now.
Yeah, so I get, well, yeah, in the beginning, and I'm old enough that that's a long time ago. Yeah, so I started life as a developer. Actually jumped over to the sales side way back when because I got tired of, how did I used to put it? People who weren't as smart as me, who made more money than me, making commitments to customers that I then had to work weekends to live up to. So that kind of drove me over the edge. And it was a long time to, I was in the hardware business for a long time. It was a long time to get back into the software world. I came here in 2006 on the support side. I was on the original Azure sales team when there were four of us in 2009. Good times. And I chose not to stick with the journey through the infrastructure as a service because I am a developer and I think it's all about the applications. And so I actually spent a couple years with a partner in a startup, and then I was recruited back into support. So I'm currently what we call, oddly, an application development manager, which is more easily understood as a dev TAM. And it allows me to be near Azure. And work with Azure without being beholden to an Azure quota, which is not a fun thing to have right now. So, and then I got really excited about the Service Fabric when I got a preview of it about 6 months before we publicly announced it. I felt like it was a real game changer. And there's actually an interesting story because Sujeet, you said you want to, you mentioned beforehand that maybe I'll talk about some stuff I've worked on since then.
Sure.
But that quote that I said in in our previous podcast, where I said I think Service Fabric is the coolest thing we've ever done, and maybe the coolest thing anybody's ever done, and so somebody actually, a customer, heard that, and then asked me why I was trying to talk him out of using it. So we can talk about that in a minute.
Cool
But
doesn't mean good for everybody in every situation, right?
well,
Cool.
you got well. Let's remember my original pod. You titled it the Service Fabric
Service
way,
Fabric way,
and that is so critical. And so when we talk about that example in a minute, you'll see how I've applied that.
Okay.
So, but that's where I'm at this point. I'm very excited about Azure Stack. As well. And I do actually share some of the excitement about blockchain. I saw a quote that blockchain is today where IP was in about 1970. Interestingly, in that quote, they were trying to imply that, it was another 25 years before IP became really world-changing with the dot-com boom. But you got to take into account that things are moving way faster now than they were then. So it's not going to take that long. But yeah, blockchain's got some very, very exciting possibilities and all of this other stuff that we do to build applications around it.
Yep, great,
So that's me.
great. So Mark, last time when we spoke to you, I think all of us, all our listeners, everything got a feel for how passionate you were about microservices. It was a very interesting discussion. I'm just wondering, since then, have you worked with any customers on microservices engagements, and what is there anything you can share? I know you said you had some interesting stories to share, but I was wondering if we could start from there and then, see where the discussion takes us.
Yeah, sure. So yeah, you and I had worked on that one account. Actually, we were working on that account, I think, when we recorded it.
Yep.
And then over the next month or two, I got pulled into actually unsuccessful engagements because it was very, very clear. I could take one look at an architecture diagram, same story. is what you and I worked on. And mm-hmm. I could tell instantly they didn't understand what microservices were. Not even the service fabric, but microservices. To them, it was just SOA.
Mm.
And we've all worked with a lot of big companies, and they claim they do SOA, but they don't really do it well. And so when you take in a light understanding of SOA, and then you try to map that onto microservices, you don't really get a good result. So a few of them, one of them is a big insurance company. I just backed off because they were determined to follow the path they were going. And there's another one that I'm actually still involved in. Same kind of story, Sujit, as when the day you and I met. I went in, they were using Enterprise Architect. They were showing the common service layer. There was no overall architecture of the application. And I turned to the guy who brought me in, the Microsoft guy, and I went, yeah, these aren't microservices. I said, we got to convince them that these are not microservices. They're just doing SOA, and they're not even doing it well. If you remember that quote in that meeting that you and I were in where I said, these aren't services, these are just classes with the word service stuck in it, stuck in the name. Right. And it was just like that. And we're still slowly convincing them that the path that they were on was very traditional and was not going to scale. They're building a huge, huge amount of data, huge amount of geographic spread, huge number of customers. And it was perfect for microservices. It's just they weren't doing microservices. So we're slowly getting them there.
So you know, I'm like struggling with why, like, you know, everyone agrees. Like it's kind of an odd thing, right? Everybody agrees that microservices is a good thing, yet so few people can adopt it in any reasonable amount of time. Like what's the big disconnect here? Like why is it so difficult to get from where people are today to microservices, knowing that it's such a good platform to, or a good way of developing software? What are the big blockers that you're seeing there besides the mental blocker that people have with the old SOA systems?
So actually, the problem goes back before SOA. It goes back to the original three-tier model, which, if we remember when that was proposed, the tiers were supposed to be loosely coupled. You're trying to eliminate dependencies. And, you know, the idea at the time is if you wanted to swap the data tier out, you could actually do that. And the way I used to describe that in my cloud presentation is I said, the problem is we took those three tiers and then we wrapped steel bands around them all and pulled them tight into a monolith.
Mm-hmm.
And then SOA, people, I don't think, wrap their heads around the loose coupling and trying to avoid the dependencies. And so the services got big. They basically, instead of having a monolith, you had a small collection of monoliths. And they had all of the dependency problems, the coupling, the code was too big and complex. And since, you know, if you've been on a SOA project and you were able to declare victory and go home, you think you get it. And then when you bring that into the microservices world, which, and you and we've talked about the problem with the reliable service model in the service fabric, is it can allow you to again grow large services.
Yeah.
And if you don't take it as fundamental that the micro is quite literal, you need to make these services small, and they need to be maintained by a single team.
Mm-hmm.
They need to be maintainable by a small team, and they need to be maintainable by different people as the team evolves. And without that cultural embrace of the change, and I would say, because I was involved in something in the 80s called CASE, computer-aided software engineering, and that was where I kind of learned, if you don't make the cultural commitment to whatever the new thing is, you don't get any benefits. You're using a hammer to pound screws is what you're doing.
I mean, this is always the fundamental problem that I think we've always had in our industry, right? In that because the industry moves so fast and there is always, you know, the new shiny is always somewhere, there is a tendency to kind of want to mash whatever it is you're doing into the current new shiny. But and that may not be a bad idea, but it's not always a good idea. And you can, just because you say you're using it, doesn't mean you're using it right.
Correct. And it's, right. Well, but I think it's more insidious than that. There's a very interesting book written by Daniel Kahneman. It's called Thinking Fast and Slow, mm-hmm. which is about how we make decisions, how all these things are kind of hardwired into us. And one of the things, and we've all heard this, right? Humans don't like change.
No.
Right? It took us a while to get comfortable with whatever skill it is we developed. And so then when we come along and say, okay, so that works for certain things, but it really doesn't work for these other things, but here's a new thing that can do those other things, but you're going to have to learn something new, most people are like, uh-uh. And CIOs actually tell us this. They what they'll say to us is, we want to reuse our existing skills. What you're telling me is, you want to keep doing what you're doing.
You don't want to change.
Right.
Exactly. And microservices, because number one, they don't stand alone. I think we talked last time, the DevOps, the CI/CD, the entire process.
Everything has to change.
Right. You have to put it, the cloud is really about a place to run your app. Microservices are how you build your app. And they work really well for the continuous delivery kind of methodology. And so when people look at Netflix and say, I want my company to work that way, well, that's how they did it. And it's got nothing to do with how enterprises build and deploy software. And so at that point, they're just completely disconnected from the benefits of microservices. And we've probably all had these conversations where we spend more time talking about what microservices aren't than what they are.
Right.
And by the way, I've said exactly the same thing about Azure, particularly in the early days. Azure was this massive sea of benefit, and we spent all of our time talking about the 10% of what it wasn't.
I remember those calls. yeah, I mean, I think that's, I mean, I think, so I guess then the question is, how do we avoid that, right? Is it really to kind of spend all that time talking about what something isn't so that you ground yourself? You know, like, so let's say I'm, I don't know, you know, I'm the next startup or hey, I'm an enterprise, right? And I want mm-hmm. to kind of start moving my architecture in this direction. What do you recommend about how somebody learns what they need to learn to do it right?
Well, so step one is the business itself needs to decide. And this is the tricky part of the conversation, because as technical people, it's really easy to slide into a tech conversation.
Absolutely.
Business decision makers could care less.
Yep.
So what we have to do, and as honestly, this is what I feel Microsoft needs to be doing, and we're kind of starting the evolutionary process with this reorg of doing that. But we need to teach the business leaders, this is how technology can make you better. These technologies can make you a better business. And you sell that vision, and then what their commitment, the only commitment they have to make is, we'll give you the air cover with the technical people to make this happen. So that's where it has to start. And then when the technical people have the air cover, there'll be more people willing to take the risk of doing something new. And this I've proven, I know this in person, because in my early days selling Azure, I met with a chief operating officer of a company in Connecticut. And I basically sold him on the value of the cloud to his company from an operating perspective. And then he said, this is great. I want you to meet with our tech team and show them how to do this. What was really cool is he was also the CIO. So he basically told his team, thou shalt. And when I walked in with the TSP, it was, okay, how do we do this? Not, well, we can't do that with it, and we can't do this with it, and we need to do this other thing with it. It was just, okay, how do we do this?
Yeah, so you had the buy-in from the top.
Right.
But that's not always the case, right?
It's almost never the case.
Oh, very rarely is, yeah, that's what I was going to say.
Well, because if we slide into a technical conversation, the business guys are going to zone on you. Mm-hmm. And what if you've ever worked on the sales side, if you're trying to have a conversation about Microsoft stuff with a business leader, he goes, oh, you need to talk to my IT guys.
Right.
And you're dead in the water at that point.
Right.
The IT guys are very well equipped to do yesterday's stuff.
Got it.
So, which leads to another problem about, and I think we'll get into this when we get to the container part of it, is that these tools were built up by devs to solve dev problems. And they're driven in the enterprise by the ops side. So you have a fundamental mismatch there that we need to work around.
Okay. I mean, when you say these tools, you mean like the service fabrics of the world and things like that?
Well, definitely DevOps and containers.
Okay.
Those are the ones that are being driven hard from the ops side right now, even though it doesn't really make sense.
Got it. Okay. Thanks. Yeah, Evan, you were going to say something?
No, I mean, I think that's, I think what Mark's saying about the business versus the technical is absolutely one of the core problems, right? I'm in support, right? I end up in those conversations by proxy because you have a business owner who's screaming because something doesn't work and they don't really care why.
Correct.
Right? They just want this application to work. And then you have the technical people debating over, well, should we fix fill in the blank this way or that way or this way? You know, what's the right way to fix it? Guys, stop. What is the fastest way to get you up and running, be it a workaround, be it fix, be it rollback, be it reinstall, whatever it is, how do we get you up and running first? Right? That's where that kind of mindset shows up in my world, but I think it's absolutely true when you're talking about on the front end of these application designs, right, for the same thing. Right? You have to figure out why you're doing it before you even talk about what the implementation is.
It's funny listening to you guys talk about this because you did mention blockchain. I spent so much time in this over the last couple of years, and it's the exact thing every time, you know, you get into these things, and the tech is so fascinating that the tech guys go crazy with it and are like, this is unbelievable because I can do all these cool things. And then immediately somebody kind of pulls on the reins and goes, hang on a second, why are we doing this? why blockchain? Why can't we do this with the existing technologies? I don't understand why we're like, holy crap, we're in crypto world here and we don't even know how we got here.
Yeah, it's a good one.
Yeah, I think this is universal, right, across everything. So I guess, you know, Mark, what would be, I mean, it sounds like one of your kind of guiding principles for folks talking about these is to really understand microservices and why they want to do it before they go do it. But let's say they get past that hurdle, right? It solves some legitimate technical need for them that helps them service a business solution, right? They're building something that is going to be at a scale that'll help or whatever the case may be. So that's kind of the business decision that, yes, this makes sense for us. What's the next step if someone says, okay, that decision's been made, now I have to get started? Where do you recommend, how do you recommend people actually go about this? Is it build a small piece? Is it take part of your existing? Like, what's your kind of thoughts on that aspect?
Yeah, that's kind of an interesting evolution for me because you guys know what the lean methodology is?
Yes.
So in the term MVP, minimum viable product, comes out of that. And I don't think it's a great idea for startups, actually, but I know it's very prevalent, which, you know, the basic idea for any listeners who haven't heard it, you need to get something into the market because until you get customer feedback, you don't know whether you have a viable idea, whether it's a good idea. And then once you have it there, you start to iterate as fast as you can. Once you get, you know, people bite, then you start adding functionality in an iterative way. And that is something that I recommend that's how these big projects start in an enterprise, because assuming you have nominal business requirements locked down, you need them to define a minimum viable product. And in fact, in that one customer I told you about that I'm still engaged with, that was the thing that I kept pushing. You need an MVP. You can't do all of this at once. And I think that's where a lot of these projects die, is you try to do too much before you know what you're doing, and then it collapses under its own weight. So my recommendation is figure out what's the smallest thing you can build using this new method. And when you've got that up, you've learned the method, you've learned what doesn't work and what you need to do differently, and then you've got a real piece of code at the end of it. Because this proof of concept thing that we push all the time, you know, like 80 to 90% of POCs go nowhere.
Yeah, the other 20% show up in my lap on the support.
Right, there you go. Right, exactly.
And we pushed it to production and it doesn't work. Okay.
Right, exactly. So, but with an MVP, a minimum viable product, what you have at the end of this first phase of the process is something that's viable. And then you can add to it. So that's how I recommend people get started in microservices. This is an ideal technique for that.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. I think the only thing I'd caution people is MVP means viable.
Oh, yeah.
I see lots of MVP things that people slap the MVP tag on it, and my response is, but it doesn't do anything I need, so it's really not viable. Okay, great. It's small, also, and it has small surface area, but it doesn't do anything useful. So.
Well, but that's where the word minimum matters.
Yeah.
Because I walked in a couple of years ago, I came into an account to actually help them, you know, with their support needs for this thing that was being built by Sujeet's side of the house. And and it was just like there was all this talk about MVP. And I said two things at that point. I felt like they had too much on it. It wasn't minimum.
Yeah.
But they insisted it was. And I said the other thing, it was the first, I listened for 30 minutes before I opened my mouth. And the first thing I said to them was, I'm a little concerned that people are treating MVP as home plate. And really, it's your path to first base and you start running hard when you get there. And by the way, they did, because the schedule wind up stripping down a lot of the features. And so I couldn't help it. I just said, well, apparently wasn't so minimal after all. But the viable is important, but the minimum is important too. Because viable, by the way, is a business term.
Yep.
So if it's viable but isn't providing business value, then it's not the minimum viable product. So I'm pointing that one to death.
So I wanted to discuss about, you know, what should the size of these things? That's always been a debatable thing, right? Yes, I mean, the size could be determined by, as you said, business value. But I was reading Martin Fowler's description on microservices. I'm sure you have, Mark.
And he says
a microservice sits between the 10 to 100 lines of code, Mark, okay? Which, I mean, for me as a developer, that seems like very small. Okay, even 100 lines seems to be a small amount of code. But one could argue that if that 100 lines of code is doing something really useful, as a business function, then that's not bad. Do you have any guiding principle on, like, you know, how big is micro or how small is micro?
So the last time we spoke, did I have reason to bring up the definition of pornography?
I don't think so.
Don't remember that. I would have remembered that one. So
there was a famous, there was an obscenity case in front of the Supreme Court in the 50s, and I don't remember the justice's name. He goes, I can't define it, but I know it when I see it.
Okay.
So for when you talk about size, absolute numbers like Mr. Fowler threw out, I think that's off the wall.
Mm-hmm.
I agree with you that 10 is way small. See, because, you know, if you remember, I love the actor model. And so, yeah, I have a bunch of methods messages, right, that it's about 10 lines of code that handle it. And 100 is probably on the high side. But the entire microservice, the entire actor, is obviously the aggregate. Maybe he meant 10 to 100 lines of code per execution. That could make sense.
No, it's a simple application that sits around the 10 to 100 lines of code, Mark.
Yeah, I don't agree with that. I think it's definitely, you know, when it's too big. I don't think there is a low side.
So there's another side to this, is that, you know, you know that every microservice has some sort of overhead, right? Because you need the communication to talk to it, you know, mm-hmm. I'm sure there's some security and whatnot overhead associated with everything. And one of the things that I read somewhere is that, you know, if the overhead, all this communications, maintenance, and everything, outweighs the utility of the application of that service, then that's not a microservice, you know. You shouldn't be doing that at all. You know, that's too small a service. Because you had so much overhead just to call that service. And remember, we're talking about a microservice is supposed to be the way that we componentize applications in this new world. And if the overhead for calling a component is much higher than the value that the component offers, maybe it shouldn't be a component.
Yeah, I think as a general idea, I think that makes sense. As long as the value is all up, meaning, so you know the difference between price and cost. So it's kind of like the same thing so the price is basically what you pay for something. So that would be like the pure overhead, where the cost could include things of, well, what if you don't do it?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So that it's a more robust thing. So yeah, in principle, if your overhead is higher than the total execution time, for instance, that logically doesn't make sense, but what if every other method of doing it had some other inefficiency involved?
Right.
Okay. So yeah, you've known me a while. I don't speak in absolutes too often.
Right. Yeah. I mean, so that's just one thing to consider. But the other thing I want to touch upon, before we kind of start winding down this discussion is about the containers, right? Because it's
yes.
something that we did. We want to touch upon that because I think one of the debates that we had is whether containers can constitute a microservices platform. Is that a good vehicle to create a microservices platform? As opposed to, say, using something like Azure Service Fabric or Service Fabric, which is, a kind of a ground-up microservices platform.
Well, that wasn't quite what our debate was.
Okay,
and thank you for calling it a debate instead of an argument.
With you, everything's a debate, Mark, you know that.
Yeah, so. Well, I try. Well, I actually was going to correct you on that, but then I went and looked up the definition. It turns out a debate and an argument are basically the same thing. So. And our discussion was because it was kind of that meeting the customer where they are and getting a foot in the door. So the question you just posed about, are containers a good platform for microservices? The answer is yes. In fact, that is what they basically are.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The answer is now, if the question is Service Fabric better than a straight container platform, then mm-hmm. the answer is yes
mm-hmm.
for that.
Yeah.
But and this is my challenge with the way containers are being implemented in the enterprise by ops. The point of containers is what's in the container. And again, it's another technology that was developed by developers to solve developer type of problems. You know, because the way you layer up the stack. The way you layer the stack up inside a container is very developer friendly. I want one of these and two of those and another one of these, and it's all in a config file and it all happens automatically.
Right.
And the discussion that you and I were having was about, well, what about if we just, to get them going, we take some sort of ASP.NET MVC app and put it in there.
Right.
And then our discussion went on into, well, the minimum stay, if you pull that layer out of the Docker repository, it's a 12 gig image.
Right.
So that kind of starts to defeat the light aspect of containers.
Correct.
Right?
That's
correct. So my point in our discussion was not that containers are bad. We weren't even, I think, having the discussion about whether Service Fabric was better than Docker for containers.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't accept that Docker is the better platform because more people are using it. That's not even a thing.
Right.
Because that's the way every new thing is. Only a few people are using it. But whether it makes sense for an ops team to think that they're buying some sort of agility or flexibility or efficiency by jamming a bunch of old, big monoliths into containers, that was kind of my point. I don't think that that's worth doing. And I think we, Microsoft, do a disservice to an operations team by validating that thinking.
Right.
So that was kind of where we were at
So taking old code, legacy code, monolithic code, and just making it into a quote-unquote container or microservice, packaging it as a microservice doesn't make it an agile platform.
Right. Well, number one, it's not a microservice at that point. Martin Fowler's definition of a microservice you can go way beyond 100 lines of code, but a full-on ASP.NET MVC app is not going to qualify.
Correct.
Right? I mean, the overhead alone.
Yep.
You've just ruined my vision of SQL Server running in a Linux container as a microservice here. Thanks, Mark.
I look at, well, do recall that the Service Fabric was built to run SQL DB.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, I see
and
that.
I would and I wonder, you know, we don't do SQL DB on Linux yet. We only do SQL Server on Linux.
Yeah, but they're the same at the end of the day. I mean, it's the Service Fabric on top of it that makes it SQL DB.
No, the SQL...
Or under it.
The Service Fabric is under it, right.
Yeah, sorry.
But I don't think we're doing... That's what makes it SQL DB, yes. And I haven't looked. I don't know when the new SQL Server on-prem that supposedly is a carved-out version of SQL DB in the cloud. I don't know how that actually is put together anymore.
Yeah, we'll talk about that offline.
Okay.
There's probably some things in there that we're probably not supposed to say publicly.
Yeah, it could be. Although I do know there was a program manager who used to do a nice presentation on how SQL DB was put together.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Anyway, sorry that I ruined any vision that you had. Although Sujeet will tell you I live to ruin visions.
Yeah, that's his first thing. He goes in, oh, everything that you're doing, you don't want to do it. That's the first thing he says. no, this is good. This is a good perspective, right? Because I think there's a lot of confusion out there you can take this stick stuff, put it in a container. And, you know, I know we talked about Windows containers being huge. And, of course, we also just recently talked about how App Service now supports Linux containers, which can be a lot smaller. Another discussion is whether App Service is also a viable microservice platform, right? We talked about Azure Service Fabric, but you know, you could also, I think we had some discussion, Mark, you and I, about using App Service as a microservice platform, and it all depends on how big you make it, right? You don't want to jam an entire MVC into an App Service and make it, and that's not your microservice platform.
Yeah, and I think one of the other challenges, you and I were kind of working through the intellectual exercise, even if you do small services in App Services, I think there were some challenges with the update model or the scaling model. Because you don't want to scale all your microservices the same.
Right, right.
And I think you and I were kind of homing in that if we do it in an app service, because of the way the scaling model works, we may wind up de facto doing that.
Yeah, yeah. Because app service uses concept of service plans or the app service plan, and that just made it a little difficult. You're correct. Yep. Good. Yeah. So that's some good perspective there, Mark, as always.
Well, there was one other thing on the containers, because this I learned from a DX guy doing a presentation on containers. If you do large monolithic applications in a container, it will work, but you get no efficiency on that host because that app is designed to scale until it has consumed all of the resources.
Correct.
So there's no benefit to throttling that container and then standing up a second one.
Right. There's no density.
Right. There's no density advantage. Yeah. What you're doing is adding another abstraction layer.
Yeah.
And that you're better off just using a VM and varying the number of cores.
Exactly right. Yep. That's a common mistake people make, thinking that, you know, containers can solve every problem. I think containers are good for lightweight applications, but definitely not a heavy ones.
I wouldn't say you can do heavy applications using.
No, what I mean heavy is like chewing up all the CPU, right?
Yeah, yeah, okay, you gotcha. Yeah, yes. Sorry,
it doesn't make any sense. Yeah.
See, the developer in me, it's all about the size of the app, the architecture.
And you know, I know we're running like way over, but I just want to mention quickly, since we talked about blockchain, there's been some fascinating work about using microservices based on top, layered on top of the blockchain system, because what they're saying is, you know, you could do this distributed ledger and blockchain where the microservices actually talk to each other using the blockchain network. It's still blows my mind, but I just wanted to mention it out there since we talked about all these technologies today.
Yeah, it sounds like there are a couple of doctoral dissertations need to get worked out first.
Some more white papers on that, man.
Yeah. And we didn't even talk about my successful customer that was the one that wondered why I was trying to talk him out of it after he listened to this podcast.
Oh, yeah. You want to just quickly mention it, Mark?
Yeah. So it was an interesting thing they had done. I was a startup who's been bought by a big bank now. They needed to scale. They had done all of their early stuff as fairly traditional web API stuff in ASEs, in app services environments, and the price was killing them. Because particularly once they joined the bank and they had to have, I think it was four different environments, the dev environment, the test environment, the QA, and then the prod. And it wasn't performing. They were very worried about scaling and they had to scale geographically. So they started looking at the service fabric and one of my peers, you know, asked me to talk to them. And I did my usual thing. I mostly spent the first two sessions trying to talk them out of it. But then ultimately I flew down to their location. And we spent 2 days together. They're doing a walk before they run. They're taking some of their web APIs and moving them into stateless reliable services. And then we had a cautious conversation about actors. Because since I talked to you guys last, the reliable collections, you have to be really careful with them. And they do have some performance limitations. So that kind of led me back into cautiously discussing actors for stateful applications rather than reliable services.
Okay.
But yeah, that's a, and that one, I think they've gone into production with the early phase now. So that was a success.
All right. That's good. I did have some, conversation with my customer about using reliable connections. I think the fact that it's limited to one region, has been, an issue for us. It doesn't cross regions unless you do the replication yourself. So this is one of the reasons why we're thinking of not using reliable connections, using stateful stateless services, and then using Cosmos DB or something on the back end for database access using the sidecar pattern, right? Like we talked about. Things, something like that. So
yeah, well, Cosmos DB with the four APIs and all of the global replication underneath. I mean, that just blows the doors off of the possibilities for a renewed data tier.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'm pretty excited about that one.
Cool. Great stuff. Well, Mark, as always, exciting discussion with you on the show. Thanks again for coming. And enlightening our listeners with your wisdom in this space. And, guys, any more questions for Mark before we wind up this rather long episode?
No, I, like last time, Mark, this is a great conversation. Appreciate your real world input.
Yeah, this was great, Mark. Thanks.
Cool. Thank you.
Right, guys.
Have a good night.
Take care, folks.
Bye.
See ya.
Thank you for listening to the show. If you have any comments or questions, please use our Twitter handle at Azure Podcasts. Background music has been taken from ccmixter.org under the Creative Commons license. Thank you, and see you next time.